Chapter 29. Transgenre Taxis.
The transgenre taxi service has been going for almost as long as the book world has been self-aware, and has adapted to the remaking with barely a murmur. TGTs are clean. The drivers have an encyclopedic knowledge of the book world that would put a librarian to shame, and they can be relied upon to bend the rules when required. For a fee. Traditionally, they rarely have change for a 20.
Bradshaw's Book World Companion, 2nd edition. The transgenre taxi head office was housed over in non-fiction, within the pages of the less-than-thrilling World Taxi Review, published bi-monthly. But travelling all the way to non-fiction would take a needlessly long time, and would alert the men in plaid before we'd even gotten as far as zoology. Luckily for us, there was a regional office located within the First Men in the Moon, located over in sci-fi slash classic. It was rumoured that the propulsion system used by the taxis was based upon a modified Cavorite design, but this was poo-pooed by sci-fi purists as unworkable. Mind you, so was the interior of a sphere book world, but that seemed to work fine too. The dispatch clerk was a small, deeply harassed individual, with the look of someone who had unwisely conditioned his hair and then slept on it wet.
"No refunds," he said as soon as we entered.
"I'm not after a refund."
"You wouldn't get one if you were. What can I do for you?"
"We're looking for a missing taxi. Took a fare from Vanity early yesterday morning." The dispatch clerk was unfazed.
"I'm afraid to say that company policy is quite strict on this matter, madam. You'll need a jurisdiction warrant."
"How's this?" I asked, slapping Thursday's shield on the counter. The dispatch clerk stared at the badge for a moment, then picked up a clipboard from under the counter and started to flick through the pages. There were a lot of them.
"You're fortunate we still have them," he said. "We file with Captain Fantastic in an hour."
He searched through them, chatting as he did so.
"We lose a couple of taxis every day to erasure, wastage, accidental reabsorption, or simply to being used in books. For obvious reasons, we're keen to hide the actual number of accidents for fear of frightening people from our cabs."
"Most thoughtful of you."
"You're in luck," he said, staring at his notes. "The only taxi missing that morning was car 1517. Its last known fare was a pick-up from Sargasso Plaza, opposite the entrance to Fan Fiction."
"On Vanity Island?"
"Right. The driver departed Sargasso Plaza, bound for the ungenred zone, at 0823. And that was the last we heard."
"You didn't think about reporting it?"
"We usually wait a week. Besides, search parties are expensive."
"Do we have a passenger name?"
"Tuesday last."
Sprocket and I looked at each other. We seemed finally to be getting somewhere.
"And the name of the driver?"
"Gatsby."
"The Great Gatsby drives taxis in his spare time?"
"No, his younger and less handsome and intelligent brother, the mediocre Gatsby. He lives in Paradis Valley over in Vanity. Here's his address."
We thanked him and left the office.
"Tuesday last," repeated Sprocket, as we hailed a cab.
"Almost certainly Thursday."
Sprocket's eyebrow pointer switched from puzzled to bingo, paused for a moment, and then switched to worried.
"Problems?" I asked, as we climbed into the cab.
"In the shape of a Buick," replied Sprocket, indicating a roadmaster that had just pulled up outside the transgenre taxi office. It was the men in plaid, and they were following the same trail we were. I leaned forward.
"Vanity Island," I said to the driver, "and step on it." Vanity wasn't a place that conventionally published people liked to visit, as it was a bizarre mixture of the best and worst prose, where iambic pentameters of exceptional beauty rubbed shoulders with dialogue so spectacularly poor it could make one's ears bleed. We skimmed low across the narrow straits that separated Vanity from the mainland, and circled the craggy island, past sprawling shanty towns of abandoned novellas, half-described castles and ragged descriptions of variable quality, before coming to land in a small square just outside Parody Valley. "You can wait for us," I said to the cabbie, who gave me a sarcastic, "Yeah, right," and left almost immediately, which made me regret I'd paid him up front and tipped him. We took a left turn into Cold Comfort Boulevard, and made our way past unpublished pastiches and parodies of famous novels that were only on Vanity at all due to their being just within the law. If they had used the same character names from the parodied novel, they were removed to the copyright tolerance haven of fan fiction. This was situated on a smaller island, close by, and joined to Vanity by a stone-arched bridge a half-mile long, and guarded by a game show host. "How long before the men in plaid follow us here?" asked Sprocket. 5 or 10 minutes," I replied, and we quickened our pace. Given that parodies, even unpublished ones, have a shelf life governed by the currency of the novel that is being parodied, the small subgenre was dominated by that year's favourites. We walked on, and once past the still popular Tolkien pastiches, we were in the unread parody hinterland, based on books either out of print themselves, or so far off the zeitgeist radar that they had little or no meaning. We took a left turn by When Nine Bells Toll, Hello, My Lovely, and I, Robert, before finding the book we were looking for, an outrageously unfunny Fitzgerald parody entitled The Diamond As Big as the South Mimms Travel Lodge. Mediocre's apartment was above a set of garages. There was a brand new taxi parked in an empty bay beneath, and we carefully climbed the rickety stairs. I knocked on the screen door, and after a few moments, a woman of slovenly demeanour stood on the threshold, gnawing a chicken drumstick. She wore heavy eyeliner that had run, and she looked as though she had just had a fight with a hairbrush, and lost.
"Yes?" she asked in a lazy manner. "Can I help?"
I flashed Thursday's badge. "Thursday next," I announced, "and this is my butler, Sprocket. Your name is?"
"Gatsby."
This was unexpected. "The mediocre Gatsby?"
"No, the loser Gatsby. The youngest of the three Gatsbys. I haven't seen Grape for a while. How did it turn out with Crazy Daisy? She looked like trouble to me."
"Not terrific, as I recall."
"Did they let Mia Farrow play her in the movie?"
"I'm not sure. Is Mediocre here?"
"I've not seen the miserable fart for 3 days," she sniffed, picking her nose. "How did you know he was missing? I didn't call you."
"May we come in?"
"I guess," said Loser Gatsby with a shrug, and we walked into the apartment.
Sprawled in the front room were a half-dozen men and women who looked as though life had not been kind to them. One of the women had been crying recently, and two of the men still were.
"This is our Siblings of More Famous Book World Personalities self-help group," explained Loser. "That's Sharon Eyre, the younger and wholly disreputable sister of Jane. Roger Yossarian, the draft dodger and coward. Brian Heap, who despite admonishments from his family continues to wash daily. Rupert Bond, still a virgin and can't keep a secret. Tracy Capulet, who has slept her way around Verona twice. And Nancy Potter, who is, well, let's just say, she's a term that is subject to several international trademark agreements."
"She's a muggle?"
"Pretty much."
They all nodded a greeting.
"We meet twice daily to try to iron out the feelings of low self-worth we experience given our more famous family members. It's quite hard, I assure you, being a nobody when an elder sister or brother is iconic for all time. Tracy Capulet was telling us what it was like living in Verona.
It's Juliet this, Juliet that, all day long, said Tracy petulantly. Juliet's on the balcony. Juliet's shagging a Montague. Juliet's pretending to be dead. Blah, blah, blah. I tell you, I'm totally sick of it.
Sprocket moved to the window and peered out. The men in plaid would be here soon. This is a matter of some urgency, I said. Does Mediocre have a room? Lusa pointed to a door, and before she could explain that it was locked, Sprocket had wrenched it off its hinges. The room was grubby, and the floor scattered with discarded pizza containers and empty hyphen cans. The TV was still on and tuned to a shopping channel, and his record collection contained Hooked on Classics and Footloose. Mediocre lived up to his name.
"What do you make of this?" asked Sprocket, who had come across a large model of the Fourth Rail Bridge.
It had large spans that in reality would have thrust boldly across the Fourth Estuary, not just to connect two land masses separated by a barrier that was also an arterial trade route, but to demonstrate man's technological prowess in the face of natural obstacles.
"It's not a bridge," I whispered. "It's metaphor."
We started opening boxes and found three more bridges, two rivers, and a distant mountain range, swathed in mist, with a road leading to unknown valleys beyond. Loser Gatsby was at the door, mouth open.
"Tell me," I said, "where did your brother get all this?"
"I don't know. Truthfully, I'm a loser," she said. "If I'd known about this little lot, I would have sold it all, gone on a bender, and had a dolphin tattooed on my left boob."
Her logic was impeccable. I questioned her further, but she knew nothing. "In 2 minutes, the men in plaid will be coming through that door," I told her. "Believe me, you don't want to be here when they do." I didn't need to say it twice, and she and the rest of the loser literary siblings made a hasty exit down the stairs.
"So," said Sprocket, staring at all the metaphor, "stolen?"
"Not if Mediocre was as his name suggests," I replied. "How much do you think this is all worth?"
"$20,000, said Sprocket. "People will pay good money to get hold of raw metaphor. There's enough here to keep a man comfortable for a long time."
"Or even enroll at Character College," I said, holding up a prospectus from St. Tabula Rasa's. Looks like Mediocre was trying to better himself and shed his epithet. "A cabbie couldn't earn this much in a decade of Octobers," I added. "I reckon we're looking at a bribe."
"To do what?"
"I don't know." I picked up Mediocre's account book. It outlined all the trips he had done and which needed to be billed. The last day was not there, of course, but the previous day was.
"Well, well," I said.
"Looks like Thursday went on a trip to Biography the day before she vanished. And that's not all," I added. "Every single fare Mediocre accepted was picked up from the same place, Sargasso Plaza, just outside the entrance to fan fiction. Coincidence?"
"We have company," murmured Sprocket, who'd been standing at the window.
I joined him, and noted that a 1949 Buick Roadmaster had pulled up outside the building. Two men in plaid got out and looked around.
"Time we weren't here."
We crossed to the other side of the room and exited through the French windows, which opened onto a veranda. From there, we climbed down onto the roof of a garden shed, then let ourselves out into an alley beyond. We walked back around the house and watched as the plaids went into the building.
"What now, ma'am?"
I handed him a set of keys I'd found in Mediocre's room and nodded towards the brand new taxi parked outside. "Can you drive one of those?"
If it has wheels, I can drive it, Mom. Are we heading for biography?
We are.
And what will we do when we get there?
Find out if Lyle is as boring as Thursday said he was.